Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, CQ's dust-up with feds gets new wrinkle. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the dateline of Raleigh. A lengthy dispute between North Carolina State Employees Credit Union and its national regulator has been ratcheted up even higher by the inadvertent disclosure that federal examiners didn't consider SECU, safe and sound back in July 2010. CQ, the nation's second-largest credit union, and the National Credit Union Administration, or NCUA, have been at odds since late 2011. Sparking the tiff was a decision by CQ's CEO Jim Blaine to release the credit union's normally secret CAMEL regulatory rating in a move he characterized as an act of added transparency. As of last fall, CQ had a CAMEL score of 2. Under the system, which applies also to banks, 1 is the strongest score possible, while 5 represents a weakness so bad that the institution is verging on collapse. Unhappy with that move, officials at NCUA have stood firm, saying they want guarantees from CQ that such disclosures will never happen again. So far, none have been forthcoming. The latest twist came in May when the Credit Union Times, a magazine that covers the industry, obtained a heavily redacted copy of an NCUA Inspector General's report on allegations that a federal examiner had made a false statement in the course of the North Carolina dispute. The examiner was cleared of the charge. However, the magazine, in transferring its copy of the report from one computer application to another, unwittingly removed the redacted portions of the document, and staffers were able to see a July 14, 2010 statement by an NCUA examiner stating that CQ is not considered safe and sound at this time. NCUA spokesman John Zimmerman pegged the inadvertent disclosure to the agency's lack of technical experience in putting out redacted documents. At the same time, he declined to provide any updates on the agency's opinions regarding CQ's soundness, saying, "We don't comment on those matters." However, a review of NCUA's publicly disclosed enforcement actions for the years 2010, 2011, and 2012 failed to turn up any instances in which federal regulators subsequently cited CQ, which has $25 billion in total assets, for unsafe practices. As to respond, Blaine says CQ is both safe and sound. The issue between CQ and its national regulator, he adds, stems from the credit union's practice of making non-conforming home mortgage loans. Non-conforming in the sense that the loans, in some particulars, use more relaxed underwriting standards than Fannie Mae. "We are busy trying to keep people in their homes," Blaine says, "and despite the 10% unemployment rates we've been having, our people are paying their loans back." Regulators, he adds, have been looking at what's been going on in California and other places, and they have been panicking. "Our portfolio is performing. Fannie and Freddie are bankrupt." Meanwhile, officials at the Raleigh-based North Carolina Credit Union League have no comment on the latest twist in the controversy. "It is what it is," says League spokesman Jeff Harden, who says the group's members simply want the issue resolved soon. And we move to the middle of the page for our next article. This article has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top half is a picture of inside the airport, a bunch of people sitting in the concourse on their computers. The caption reads, "Passengers play the waiting game at Raleigh-Durham International Airport." And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, "Fare costs up, up, up. On per mile basis, ticket prices up significantly since 2005. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Morrisville. Travelers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport in 2011 were paying nearly 50% more for each mile they flew than they did in 2005. Even as they boarded increasingly crowded aircraft and ponied up to check bags, rent pillows, and even get a snack. The average cost to fly a single mile is a standard industry metric known as yield. The yield for flights from RDU hit 18 cents in 2011, says Mike Boyd of Boyd Group International, a Colorado airline consultant. That was up from 16 cents in 2010 and from 14.2 cents in 2009. The metric was at 14.7 cents in 2006 before the recession hit, up from 12.8 cents in 2005. Boyd says the increases at RDU are roughly in line with those at other airports. Analysts and industry representatives pointed to surging fuel prices to explain fare hikes through much of 2011. Resurgent demand became part of the explanation in the fall as economic growth began to strengthen. The most dramatic change in the last year has been cuts in capacity, the number of seats available. Carriers began flying smaller aircraft on many routes in the fall, and Boyd says the results have been a near disappearance of discounted tickets. In contrast, business class fares have increased only marginally, Boyd says. The people that paid less, they're not even in the air now, Boyd says. Besides paying more for a ticket, passengers are paying in other ways as well, most notably through fees to check bags. Revenue from that source alone grew to nearly $3.4 billion in both 2010 and 2011, from less than $500 million in 2007. In several recent quarters, such revenue was greater than airlines' entire operating profit. Still, passenger numbers are clearly growing at RDU, about 4.58 million passengers boarded in 2011, up by a fraction of a percent from 2010. Enplanements increased by nearly 6% in the first 4 months of 2012 compared to the first 4 months of 2011. The trend toward fuller airplanes goes back a generation, industry analysts say. Higher fuel prices have gradually pushed airlines to operate more efficiently. Load factor, which measures the percentage of seats filled on the average airplane, rose from 72% in 2000 to 82% in 2010 and 2011, according to federal data. It used to be that if you did about 53, 55, 57%, you were making money, says airline consultant Bill Fife, a former director for New York City area airports. Now, on good days, you're looking at 98% on major routes. Growing load capacity and yield helped the industry post a combined $10.5 billion operating profit in 2010, a dramatic turnaround from the cumulative $1 billion loss they posted in 2008 and 2009. Their operating profits still shrank last year to $7.1 billion as fuel prices rose. But Boyd, Fife, and industry consultant Roy Williams say profits have headed sharply upward in the last couple of months as falling fuel prices combined with the higher average fares. Williams, an industry consultant who managed airports in New Orleans and Dayton, Ohio, notes that fuel has overtaken labor as the industry's leading expense. Meanwhile, flights from RDU are still noticeably cheaper than those from other airports in Georgia and the Carolinas, according to Boyd's analysis, which he prepared for Triangle Business Journal based on data from the U.S. Department of Transportation. Airlines' average yield in Atlanta last year was 20 cents. In Charlotte, it was 21.4 cents. While several studies have highlighted the relatively modest landing fees and lease rates that RDU charges carriers, Boyd also points to its relatively vigorous competition. In contrast, Delta Airlines dominates in Atlanta, and U.S. Airways dominates in Charlotte. RDU marketing director Teresa Damino notes that yield also varied because the mix of destinations varies from one airport to the next. What airlines are chasing today is how much revenue they can make, and revenue is how much people will pay for a certain route, Damiano says. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This column or this article runs vertically along the right-hand side of the page. The headline, BDSI Making Strides Maps Out Its Strategy. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. And then underneath the article, there's a picture of a man wearing a jacket, open collared shirt, sitting in his office or standing in his office. The caption reads, Mark Sergo talks of a bright future for BDSI. Having earned milestone payments of a combined $45 million since the beginning of 2012, BioDelivery Sciences International is breathing a little easier nowadays. CEO Mark Sergo says BDSI has enough cash through the first quarter of 2013 and may consider bringing in a new drug for development. That would be a big step for a company that at the beginning of this year had a market capitalization of less than $25 million. It's now at around $108 million. The biggest event that turned the tide for BioDelivery was a partnership with Endo Pharmaceuticals based in Chadds Ford, Pennsylvania. Per the agreement, BioDelivery sold worldwide marketing and sales rights of one of its drugs to Endo for $30 million upfront and up to another $150 million based on various development and sales milestones. In May, BioDelivery received $15 million under that agreement. Surgil calls the deal with Endo one of the most important in the company's recent history. "We think that really will transform the company," he says. Investors took note. The stock price more than doubled in the wake of the milestone announcement, though it's still selling in penny stock territory at less than $4 a share. Still, some analysts are high on BioDelivery's prospects. In a research note, Roth Capital Partners analyst Scott R. Henry writes that BioDelivery science offers one of the most attractive risk-reward propositions in our coverage universe. Roth Capital seeks to do business with companies such as BDSI, and an analyst at Roth owns shares in BDSI. On April 28, Jim Van Merten, who blogs for The Motley Fool and publishes an investor newsletter called Financial Tides, notes BioDelivery as one of three stocks with, quote, "the most consistent momentum," unquote. At the center of the deal with Endo is BioDelivery's drug Bema, B-E-M-A, buprenorphine, which is delivered through a film placed inside a person's cheek for management of moderate to severe chronic pain. In 2010, the market for such drugs hit $10 billion a year, and BioDelivery says its drug has the potential to generate more than $500 million of that amount. Looking ahead, Surgo says BioDelivery can now develop another drug and possibly take it to market without a partner. He says that would transform BDSI from a drug development company to a drug manufacturer, which would improve profit potential. The drug under development would treat opioid dependence through the abuse deterrent naloxone. Again, it would use the film strip to deliver the drug and is called Bema, B-E-M-A, buprenorphine naloxone. The only company currently selling an opioid dependence drug is Reckitt Benckiser Pharmaceuticals, United Kingdom Pharma, that developed a film delivery system in partnership with Portage, Indiana-based Monosol Rx. In the past year, Monosol has filed several patent infringement claims against BioDelivery, but the U.S. Patent Office has rejected those claims. Surgo says he does not expect to knock out Reckitt Benckiser, but rather aims to become a competitor. To get to the market, Surgo is in a race against a Swedish company called Orexo AB, which is developing a treatment for opioid dependence called OX-219. That drug is currently in Phase 3 testing, according to Orexo. BioDelivery is just in Phase 1. Surgo says the market could bear three companies selling drugs for the same purpose, but being in the market first would make a difference. "The order of entry is important," he says. "That doesn't mean you can't make money if Orexo launches its product first, but that's not our goal. We want to be next." And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off: Soleil's Mundra sells house for $4 million below ask. And under that, there's a picture from out front of a very nice house, very large house. The caption reads, "Mark and Victoria Laporte paid $2.8 million for estate." One of the partners in the ill-fated Soleil Center, a proposed 43-story hotel and condominium project in Raleigh's Crabtree Valley, has taken a bath on the sale of his North Raleigh estate. After nearly 2 years of trying, Sanjay Mundra has found a buyer for the 17,792-square-foot estate he built in the 29-lot The Barony gated community in 2008. But the sale price, $2.8 million, is less than half of Mundra's original asking price of $6.99 million. He put it on the market in the fall of 2010. Still, it is the highest price paid this year for a home in the Triangle, and it tops the highest price paid for a local home in 2011. That one went for $2.4 million. Mundra coincidentally sold the estate to another local hotel developer. Concord Hospitality Enterprises President and CEO Mark Laporte and his wife Victoria. The 7-bedroom, 9-bath home has a swimming pool and hot tub, handball court, 8-seat movie theater, indoor and outdoor kitchen, and an ornate curved marble staircase leading to the second floor. When Joe Hutchinson chose his college, he picked UNC Chapel Hill, where the freshman from Melksham, England, competes as a decathlete. But now the homeland has beckoned Joe back, and he's proud to go. He was chosen among British athletes to carry the Olympic torch near his hometown as the flame makes its way to London for the start of the Summer Olympics. He will be one of 300 different runners a day who will carry the torch for 60 days before the Games. A lot of sporting heroes that I loved growing up carried the torch, and now I have the opportunity to carry it, Hutchinson told the Daily Tar Heel. Just one piece of advice from Biz, don't let the flame go out. The market at Colonnade Shopping Center in North Raleigh, with its complicated underground stormwater drainage system, has received an official seal of approval from the U.S. Green Building Council for LEED, L-E-E-D, Silver certification. The center's anchor tenant, Whole Foods Market, has garnered LEED Gold certification for commercial interiors and has partnered with the U.S. Department of Energy and its Net Zero Program Commercial Building Initiative to create an energy-efficient grocery space. Florida-based Regency Centers, owner of Market at Colonnade, currently has 17 LEED-registered retail development projects in its pipeline. North Carolina State University professor Zhuzhan Zhang wants to better protect smartphone users on the Android platform. To that end, he has launched the Android Malware Genome Project and has already collected 1,200 pieces of Android malware. Zhang says he does not have detailed numbers on the infected users, but based on earlier reports, some malware like Droid Dream or Droid Dream Lite easily infects the platforms of more than 120,000 users. Essentially, his project will help researchers at NC State better understand the malware and therefore better defend against it, sort of a know-your-enemy approach. The Android Malware Genome Project aims to share recent Android malware samples within the research community to boost our defense capabilities, Zhang says. A local shirt for a local team. That's what the Durham Bulls baseball team has on its mind when thinking about the Bull City. The Bulls and collegiate clothing company Schoolhouse put their heads together to design and make a line of shirts from 100% recycled materials at Schoolhouse's garment factory, just 3 miles from the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. As their name suggests, the beer bottle brown, water bottle blue, and X-ray gray tees are named after the materials used to create each line. Schoolhouse founder and CEO Rachel Weeks, a self-proclaimed proud Durhamite, has long been a proponent of local manufacturing and calls the new line a labor of love. Campbell University drew 58 college students to its 7th Healthcare Professionals Readiness and Enrichment Program, a 3-day seminar designed to help students become stronger applicants for advanced degrees in healthcare. The program is geared toward financially disadvantaged and underrepresented minority students who are highly qualified in the field of health sciences, according to the university. Students stayed in Buies Creek and attended a full schedule of classes and workshops. Email marketing firm Bronto is growing. The company just celebrated its 10th birthday and is in the middle of a 3,000-square-foot expansion at American Tobacco Campus in Durham. By mid-June, their ATC footprint will be about 27,000 feet. More than 20 people have been hired this year, and it's not leveling off. CEO Joe Colopy says Bronto grew its employee base by 50% last year, and this year he hopes to make the workforce total from 125 to 150. In addition to the space in Durham, Colopy says outposts will be established to serve the Australia, Asia, South Pacific market. But for now, he plans to pace himself, focusing energy and efforts into Durham and London. Last year, Bronto ended at just under $17 million in revenue. He expects more than $20 million by 2013. Smith Anderson, the Triangle's largest law firm, has been selected as one of 30 finalists for the 2012 Secretary of Defense Employer Support Freedom Award. The U.S. Defense Department bestows the award each year to an employer that has given exceptional support to employees who are members of the National Guard or military reserve officers, for example, by helping reservists and National Guard members returning home from deployment. If you have some questions for health insurance providers, a June 14 event might be your time to ask. Margie Maxwell, president of Aetna's Southeastern Markets, Brad Wilson, president and CEO, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, Charles C. Pitts, president and general manager, Cigna Healthcare Carolinas, Garland Scott, CEO of United Healthcare's Carolina Markets, and Tracy Baker, president and CEO, WellPath, will be the speakers at a panel discussion hosted by Hill, Chesson & Woody, a healthcare and welfare benefits brokerage and consulting firm. The event will be from 7:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. at the RTP Sheridan Imperial at 4700 Emperor Boulevard. Owners of electric vehicles, such as the Chevy Volt or Nissan Leaf, now can find the juice they need in Orange County, where 12 electric charging stations were installed in May. Using funds from the U.S. Department of Energy and the American Recovery and Investment Act, the county installed 12 Level 2 stations in three locations that are capable of recharging a car in 3 to 6 hours. The charging stations are free while usage patterns and an appropriate pricing schedule are evaluated. Six stations are at the Park and Ride facility at the Hillsboro campus of Durham Technical Community College. Four stations are at the Orange County Skills Development Center at 503 West Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Two stations are available at the Robert and Pearl Seymour Senior Center at 2551 Homestead Road in Chapel Hill. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Jason DeBrun, Lauren Onsorge, and Chris Bagley. And now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, Tampa Firm Wants to Expand from Raleigh. And this article is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. With a $39.8 million investment in North Carolina, the principals of Tampa, Florida real estate firm Landever, LLC, not only have gained access to 2,300 housing sites in the Triangle and on the coast, they also have planted a flag for future investments here. Raleigh has always been a target market for us, even when we were both with another company, says Adam Laurie, who along with David Frame founded Landever in 2007 with the financial backing of the private equity real estate firm Walton Street Capital of Chicago. Landever in mid-May purchased from Wells Fargo the 687-acre 12 Oaks Golf Course community in Holly Springs, paying $29.2 million for the property's 1,812 remaining home sites and the Jack Nicklaus Design Golf Course. Wells Fargo and its predecessor, Wachovia Bank, had invested almost $32 million in the property by 2010 when the decision was made to put the property into receivership after its previous owner defaulted on the loan. Wells Fargo's portfolio also included the 195-acre Bogue Watch community in Newport that the LandQuest real estate firm in Raleigh had once controlled, and the 129-acre Anchors Bend community on the Intercoastal Waterway in Wilmington. Landever paid $4.6 million for Bogue Watch and $6 million for Anchors Bend, according to county deed records. In the same transaction, Landever bought 439 acres in the McCune Plantation development near Charleston, South Carolina, for $6.35 million. Bill Honecker, senior vice president of Wells Fargo's real estate-owned group in Raleigh, says the bank had made significant investments in the properties to protect and enhance their value. There was significant interest in the original offering, and we are pleased with the results of the sale, he says. We believe that Landever and their partners are high-quality owners who will continue to support these properties over the long term. Since 12 Oaks was assigned to a receiver, the community has been righted and ranks among the five most active master planned communities in the Triangle, according to Jay Colvin of Metro Study in Raleigh, a research firm that tracks the sale of new homes in the region. Laurie says the firm has hired several management team members from 12 Oaks Receivership Company to stay on full-time, including General Manager David Mason. For the residents and for Holly Springs, this should be very seamless, he says. That project has a lot of momentum, and we want to make sure the transition is smooth. Our challenge is to figure out how to add to that momentum. Laurie says Landever will be using 12 Oaks as a platform from which it will grow its investments in the Triangle. We will be acquiring and growing more in Raleigh, he says. The coastal properties, he says, were a bonus. The coast was more opportunistic for us, but we were pleasantly surprised with the quality of the projects and the positions they held. In the Triangle, Wells Fargo still owns the 1,400 acres Wendell Falls community in eastern Way County after rejecting previous offers for the land. And our next article is also written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This one has a dateline of Morrisville. The headline, Quietly, Swiss firm Tekken plots Triangle expansion. And that's Tekken spelled T-E-C-A-N. The U.S. headquarters of a Swiss company that makes laboratory instruments is expanding its operations in the Triangle with a move from Durham to Morrisville in July. Tekken Group of Switzerland is marking its 30th year in North Carolina, but the company has largely stayed under the radar locally as it focused on its customers across the Western Hemisphere. Mark Hoza, head of commercial operations for the Americas and president of Tekken U.S., says the company has been gradually growing its base of operations in Durham over the past 10 years and is in need of more office and warehouse space. The company is moving out of about 43,000 square feet on Stirrup Creek Drive in Durham and has leased 59,000 square feet at the Globe Center Industrial Park in Morrisville. Tekken makes laboratory instruments used to analyze blood, drug, and other liquid samples, mostly for companies in the life sciences industry. Researchers and lab technicians use Tekken equipment and solutions to automate or semi-automate laboratory processes. Although Tekken manufactures no products in the Triangle, the Durham office is the company's base of operations for sales, service, and distribution for all of North America and South America, Hoza says. It has about 80 employees based in Durham and another 95 working with clients across the country and in Canada, Mexico, Central America, and South America who report to Hoza and his staff in Durham. Tekken plays a key role in the Triangle region's growing advanced medical technologies industry cluster, says Ken Atkins, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development. As we look at our focus on individual clusters, advanced medical technologies is clearly one we are working to grow and expand, Atkins says. Companies like Tekken provide that full-service part of the cluster with all kinds of providers coming together. Although they don't manufacture here, the fact that they are here and have that experience and serviceability strengthens that cluster in the Triangle. Tekken's life science business in the Americas accounts for about 40% of the company's overall corporate revenue, according to the company's latest annual report. In North America, Tekken achieved sales growth of 4.3% in Swiss francs in 2011, but in local currency, sales in North America rose by 19.6%. Yes, they are absolutely paying attention to what is happening here, both good days and bad days, Hoza says of his corporate bosses in Switzerland. He typically travels to Europe at least once a month to keep them briefed. Hoza says he expects that more employees will be added as needed once the office move and expansion in Morrisville is complete, but being a European company, we are on the conservative side, he says. There was, Hoza says, never any discussion about moving Tekken's operations outside of the Triangle. It's been clear from the beginning where we want to be, he says, noting that many of Tekken's largest life science clients also have large operations in the region, including Laboratory Corporation of America in Burlington and pharmaceutical firm Merck, which has a large plant in Durham. Tekken will be moving into the former pharmaceutical space at Globe Center that's been mostly empty for 8 years. The building already had a fully air-conditioned warehouse with high ceilings and adequate office space, both of which were requirements for Tekken, says Michael Morgan of the Jones Lang LaSalle real estate firm in Raleigh. Jim Lepley with Craig Davis Properties in Cary represented UBS, the owner of the building. Tekken currently has 7 job openings in the U.S., 4 of which will be reporting to the Durham office. The others report to Tekken office in San Jose, California, where its Tekken Systems Incorporated subsidiary is based. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is in the center of the page. It has a black border around it. The top half inside the border is a picture of a man wearing glasses, casually dressed, denim shirt, standing in the middle of a restaurant. The caption reads, Michael Chong says he wants a more intimate restaurant experience. And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, Going local, on his own. Farm-to-table restaurant in Chapel Hill planned by former On chef. And under that is the article. But in the corner, the bottom left corner, there's a picture of a woman in business attire. The caption next to her reads, Chong worked with Ann Goodnight to open On. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Chapel Hill. Noted local chef Michael Chong, who left the rarefied air of high-end dining in January, plans to open his own farm-to-table restaurant in Chapel Hill this summer. Chong's last post was as executive chef of On New World Cuisine in Cary, a pan-Asian-style restaurant that he helped open in 2006 with the backing of Ann Goodnight, wife of SAS Institute CEO and billionaire Jim Goodnight. Prior to On, Chong was executive chef at Prestonwood Country Club in Cary. Chong, a native of Vietnam who moved to the United States in 1979 when he was 15 years old, says that after 26 years working in kitchens designed to serve large crowds, he wanted a restaurant where he could add his own personal touch and pay closer attention to the quality of the food on each plate. He plans to open his own place called Elements at the East 54 community in August. He says Elements will feature modern and contemporary American dishes using produce and meats purchased from local farms and farmers' markets. The menu, Chong says, will change weekly depending on the food products that are in season and available. Leslie Strax Mullum, co-owner of Taste Carolina Gourmet Food Tours, says the farm-to-table movement in the Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Durham area has grown stronger over the past few years as restaurants such as Lantern in Chapel Hill and Piedmont in Durham began serving dishes with almost 100% locally produced ingredients. It's almost expected to see a list of farms that are supplying ingredients when you walk in, Strax Mullum says. Not necessarily every ingredient has to be local, but most people want to know that the chef and owner are supporting local farms and artisans. It really is expected here. Chong's restaurant will be in a 3,535 square foot N unit space that was recently vacated when the Archira Thai and Sushi restaurant closed, confirms Ty Thomas, a real estate broker with Lincoln Harris, who represented the owners of East 54 in the lease negotiations. By comparison, On occupies a building that is 8,000 square feet at the Arboretum at Weston Retail Center on Weston Parkway in Cary. Chong was succeeded by Stephen Devereaux Green as executive chef at On in January. Green previously was chef de cuisine at Heron's, the restaurant in the Umstead Hotel and Spa, which is also owned by the Goodnights. Chong says he has no partners nor any big financial backers to help him finance Elements, so the restaurant will have a much more minimalistic core and menu when compared to the elegant decor and vast food and wine listed on. On was more commercial. This will be more personal, he says, of Elements. No food packed for Wake Tech. That's the headline on our next article. This one's written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Raleigh. And under the picture, or under the article, there's a picture of two women standing in a kitchen, casually dressed. The caption reads, Deborah Wallace and Pamela Brown will continue to oversee Wake Tech's food operations. Wake Technical Community College has abandoned plans to find one management group to oversee all food service contracts. Seven groups showed up for a pre-bid meeting, but when the proposals came in, there were only piecemeal offers, not what the business office wanted. I was very disappointed, says Deborah Wallace, Wake Tech's chief business officer, so we punted that idea. For this year, Wake Tech will itself continue to manage the contracts with vendors, such as the Pizza Shack and Subway. The school promoted Pamela Brown to associate business service manager for that task. Next year, Wake Tech will again look to find one management company to handle all day-to-day operations. We want more of a partnership between us and the vendors, says Wallace. For food service vendors, the type of contract sought by Wake Tech did not make business sense, says Ian Laskowski, development and leasing associate for the North Carolina Subway Group Incorporated, which has been the primary food service provider on the main campus for the past 5 years and submitted a partial bid. While we would have enjoyed the opportunity to continue our relationship with Wake Tech, we did not feel that satisfying all components of the RFP would have fit our business model at this time, Laskowski says. The community college makes very little in commission, but the value comes in being able to offer food on campus, one of the largest community colleges in the state, Wake Tech sees more than 64,000 students in a year. At the university level, food service contracts are negotiated much the same way. Individual institutions negotiate an independent contract, and there are different ways to go about setting up a food vendor, says Joni Worthington, University of North Carolina System Vice President of Communications. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill has a single contract with Aramark Corporation, which then manages all food service, including for its cafeterias and the Chick-fil-A, Quiznos, Subway, and Starbucks on campus, says Scott Myers, UNC Chapel Hill Director of Food and Vending. The university does about $30 million in annual food sales and just renewed the contract with Aramark for 10 years. It will run through 2021. North Carolina State University, by contrast, is one of the few major universities to operate its own food service program. University staff operate 26 locations on campus, and any branded locations operate under a franchise agreement in which those workers are technically state employees. The branded restaurants of Chick-fil-A, two locations, Taco Bell, Freshens, and Port City Java, seven locations, account for $4.5 million, or 15%, of total food service revenues. For its part, Duke University operates a hybrid of the two models. It has a contract with Bon Appetit Management Company that manages several food vendors, but also has separate contracts for other providers, like a Loco Pops place on East Campus, for example. Food service at a college is different, largely because the student body is made up of commuters instead of a mix of commuters and residents. Because of that, a larger percentage of students eat off campus or at their homes instead of on campus, Wallace says. And now turning to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. First, we'll read the nonprofit news section. With help from a $1.2 million grant from the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina Foundation, the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services will try to improve school nutrition and lower childhood obesity. In particular, the grant will buy five refrigerated trucks to bring locally grown fruits and vegetables to 35 more school systems statewide. There is also an educational component to teach students about healthy food choices. Communities in schools of North Carolina received $80,000 in grants from State Farm, SunTrust, Progress Energy, and GlaxoSmithKline. The funding will help broaden the organization's service learning programs, including regional training workshops for teachers and community members, and funding for new projects. Thanks to a $2,500 donation from RTI International, the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina distributed 20,000 pounds of sweet potatoes in Person County and 40,000 pounds in Wake County. Later, BB&T employees volunteered at the food bank's warehouse as part of their Lighthouse Project to enhance the quality of life for residents throughout our communities. And next we have the Philanthropy News Desk column written by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, GSK Foundation Beefs Up Its Grants Program. And in the column there's a picture of a woman wearing a business suit standing outside of a building. The caption reads, Marilyn Foot Hudson Heads Up GSK Foundation. When its endowment plunged from $76.4 million in October 2007 to $39.5 million in February 2009 following the collapse of the economy in September 2008, the board of the North Carolina GlaxoSmithKline Foundation bucked the philanthropic trend and dug deeper, including a new effort to address needs in communities that lacked local funders. They felt they could not pull away and reduce their support for the citizens of North Carolina, particularly at a time when that need was at its all-time greatest, says Marilyn Foot Hudson, the Durham-based foundation's executive director. Formed in 1986, the foundation has approved nearly $60 million in grants, including over $4 million it approved and $3.3 million it has paid out this fiscal year. This year's fund includes $2.1 million for the new grants program that aims to reach all of North Carolina's 100 counties through one-time grants of $25,000 to nonprofits for projects that boost science, health, and education in their communities. Education, often to support science or health, and typically delivered through campuses of the University of North Carolina system, including efforts to support education in kindergarten through high school, is the main focus of the foundation's funding. It's all about education, Foot Hudson says. We are an education foundation. While the new program focuses on smaller grants to nonprofits and local communities, the foundation typically makes a handful of big grants each year to address overarching educational initiatives. This fiscal year, for example, it approved a 5-year grant of $2 million to the North Carolina Museum of Art to help integrate art into the classroom by providing teachers with resources to help students develop critical thinking and problem-solving skills. It also approved a 3-year grant of $1 million to the General Administration of the University of North Carolina system to provide access to higher education to 6 UNC campuses for students who struggle because they learn differently. And it recently approved a 3-year grant of $1.5 million to North Carolina Central University in Durham for scholarships and program improvements to increase the number of women and minority students who graduate with a degree in science, technology, engineering, or math, known as STEM, and to pursue careers in those fields. Since 1993, the foundation also has paid more than $1.6 million to support its Women in Science Scholars Program at 29 North Carolina colleges and universities, providing an endowed scholarship for students studying science, and pairing them with professional women scientists at GSK who volunteer to serve as mentors. And it provides annual awards of $5,000 and $2,000 each, respectively, or a total of about $100,000 a year, that recognize local health departments and individual advocates for improving the health status of children. The vast majority of the foundation's grants support the UNC system, a public institution that is struggling in the face of the economic downturn with the number of course offerings and faculty being cut, Foot Hudson says. Our commitment is to support the citizens of North Carolina, she says. Public institutions are the place to do that. And in the last section on this page, there's People on the Move. The Ronald McDonald House of Durham hired Nancy Arne Jones as Director of Development and Communications. She has more than 20 years of experience in the nonprofit and fundraising arenas. The Greater Raleigh Chapter of the National Association of Women Business Owners named Sharon Hill as its 2012 to 2013 board president. She has been a NAWBO member since 2004 and has served as program's chairperson for 2 years. Perry Colwell, a volunteer and former board member of Executive Service Corps of the Triangle in Durham, received Governor's Medallion Award for Volunteer Service for Durham. Elizabeth Biggerstaff was named annual fund manager at the John Avery Boys and Girls Club in Durham. Lee Cheney, former nonprofit volunteer and employee, was named program director at the club. And now our next full-length article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, First Citizens at Odds with the SBA Over Federal Payments. Raleigh Bank states it does not know how much money SBA is claiming from California Buy. And next to the article, there's a large picture of a woman in business attire giving a speech, standing at a podium. A large sign for the U.S. Small Business Administration behind her and also on the front of the podium she's at. The caption reads, SBA Chief Karen Mills has partnered with the FDIC to enter the loss share area. First Citizens Bank says it plans to vigorously protect its interests in a dispute with the U.S. Small Business Administration over federal payments First Citizens receives for having agreed to acquire failed banks. The so-called loss share payments come from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and cover First Citizens for up to 80% of any losses it suffers on loans acquired from failed banks. First Citizens says in a recent regulatory filing, it began receiving communications from the SBA in March saying that the agency is entitled to proportionate shares of FDIC payments already paid, or to be paid, to the bank in connection with First Citizens' July 2009 acquisition of Temecula Bank in California. First Citizens has yet to put a dollar figure on the size of the payments SBA is claiming, or what effect any payouts would have on the bank's bottom line. Asked to provide details, bank spokesman Frank Smith pointed to the First Citizens quarterly statement, adding that this constitutes our comments on the matter. The Temecula deal, in which First Citizens acquired assets totaling $1.3 billion, was the first of six FDIC-assisted transactions done by the Raleigh Bank. None of those other acquisitions apparently have surfaced in the payments dispute with the SBA so far. Because of those deals, First Citizens now has roughly $2.24 billion of its $14 billion in loans covered by FDIC loss share agreements. Through December, the bank had received about $346 million in loss share payments from the FDIC on the acquisitions, according to First Citizens' annual report. SBA spokesman Mike Stamler says the agency ironed out an agreement with the FDIC in January that's allowing it to enter the loss share area. It had the statutory authority to do so before that, he adds, but wasn't exercising it. SBA loans are written by banks and backed by the federal government for up to 80% of their value. If a loan goes bad, the SBA pays the bank 80 cents on the dollar. If an SBA loan becomes part of a failed bank deal and subsequently defaults, any loss share from the loan's new owner receives must be divided with the SBA according to the agreement. It's something that banks are just going to have to take into account when they make those loss share agreements, says Julie Jurasik, an SBA expert with Lima, Ohio-based Anchor Financial Management. At the same time, I can see how some banks feel that they have been blindsided by the way they came about. In our next article, written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dayline of Raleigh, has the headline, REO Deed Wagon Tunes Programs for Banks. Bankers Association wants to help institutions get rid of their foreclosed real estate properties. With its database of for sale homes and commercial real estate growing, an industry buzz about it heating up, the North Carolina Bankers Association's REODeedWagon.com has wheels. NCBA launched the effort a little over a month ago to help North Carolina banks dispose of property taken in foreclosure proceedings. To date, 250 properties are up on the website, including a large smattering of homes, commercial properties, and even raw land. And we are getting more in daily, says the NCBA's Brandon Wright, who oversees the online effort. In fact, adds Wright, NCBA is currently in talks with other state banking associations to explore the potential of taking the deed wagon across state lines, if not going national. REO in banking terminology stands for Real Estate Owned, an accounting entry. Obviously, the name of NCBA's website borrows from much from the 1970s rock band REO Speedwagon. It's been a fact not missed by the banking industry trade press, which has been busy taking old song titles out of mothballs to write about the North Carolina offerings. Take it on the run, banks create website, is how American Banker headlined a mid-May piece. The pace of sales of real estate-owned properties could hardly be called speedy, wrote the magazine's Kate Berry, but the North Carolina Bankers Association is hoping to help banks hurry up. Wright says the name just spilled out one day during an NCBA skull session. We were apprehensive about it at first, he allows, explaining, however, that those early qualms quickly disappears. It rolls off the tongue. It works. The idea behind it is simple. Banks pay $49 to list their foreclosed properties on the site, which is open for inspection by anyone, including presumably potential buyers. For the filing fee, the bank gets space to describe the property in detail and to put in a price and contact information. The banks have the option of including their name with the listing, but, says Wright, must have opted to list the name of their brokers. Most have opted to list the name of their brokers. All of the banks listing to this point are North Carolina-based lenders, many of them in the community bank category, but there are some larger ones as well. Wright says in the month since the site fired up, there have been a couple of sales, a fact prompting the NCBA to realize that it is going to have to develop tracking procedures to find out if such transactions are actually linked to the site. While internet offerings abound that list bank-owned homes for sale, few list commercial and other types of real estate, and none can say, as REO Deedwagon does, that it's a site for bankers run by bankers. That may give it credibility in the industry, but an even greater assist comes from the costs banks face in keeping foreclosed properties on their books. The costs are numerous, says banking analyst Don Coker, and that's why banks try to move those properties as quickly as they can. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is in the legal spotlight. The headline, Business Bankruptcies Soar in Triangle. This article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. Businesses with large debts should be proactive, open, and honest in negotiating with their creditors, people involved in the process say. That advice comes as ever larger and otherwise healthy businesses are falling into bankruptcy. While most sectors of the economy are rebounding, the recovery hasn't been fast or strong enough to rescue all the businesses with loans coming due. A total of 125 new Chapter 11 petitions were filed in U.S. bankruptcy court for the Eastern District of North Carolina in 2011, more than double the total from 2010. The number is on track to double again in 2012. Bankruptcy is and should be a last resort for most companies, particularly those that will rely heavily on borrowing or credit purchase in the future, says attorneys for both debtors and creditors. If there's a bankruptcy on file, it's going to have a very negative impact for a very long time, says Rod Griffin, a spokesman for Experian, a provider of credit reports. Griffin adds that lenders usually consider a credit report in its entirety and alongside current financial statements rather than focusing solely on a past bankruptcy. A company with a past bankruptcy and a history of late payments is usually considered a higher risk than one with only a bankruptcy, he says. Still, attorneys say bankruptcies are being filed more and more often by companies with otherwise clean credit histories, a trend that will force more of them to pay higher interest rates on future debts. In several recent bankruptcies, a debtor reported strong business but was unable to renew, renegotiate, or replace a single loan because its collateral for the loan had depreciated. Companies should start renegotiating at least a year before a loan comes due, says Trawick Buzzy Stubbs, a New Bern attorney who represents debtor business. If a company doubts its ability to avoid default, it should go ahead and stop making payments. The banks won't listen to you until you stop paying, Stubbs says. The mistake people make is to keep making your payments instead of conserving your cash. A default or a renegotiated loan also hurts a business's credit rating, albeit less severely than a bankruptcy, Griffin notes. Planning months in advance gives the lender time to renegotiate before a default, Stubbs says. That's particularly true when a bank has bundled a commercial mortgage, with hundreds of others and sold the bundle to a third-party investor whose consent may be necessary, he says. Debtors should also keep clear, accurate, and up-to-date financial records so the lender will know exactly whether a renegotiation will lead to repayment, says David Dinkwarren, who represents lenders at Pointer Spruill in Raleigh. It gives the bank more latitude in trying to come up with alternatives, Warren says. The worst thing a borrower can do is hide the ball from the bank. The bank assumes the worst. And for our remaining minutes, reading the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the trianglebusinessjournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Bayer Crop Sciences Evergoal gets okay. A new fungicide treatment developed by Bayer Crop Science, which has its U.S. headquarters in Research Triangle Park, has been approved for use in the United States. Bayer Crop Science's Evergoal, a seed treatment to protect against fungal crop disease, Rhizoctonia, and other establishment-inhibiting diseases, will be available next year to protect cotton, canola, and wheat. Evergoal trade names in the United States will include Evergoal Prime, Prosper Evergoal, and Evergoal Energy. The seed treatment was registered by the Environmental Protection Agency last week. Debts down for North Carolina local governments. The amount of debt being carried by the state's 100 counties and thousands of cities and towns continues to head downward, but publicly financed construction projects are still looking for a rebound. As of April, the amount of local debt in the state was $28.4 billion, down by 1% from the same month in 2011, according to the North Carolina Treasurer's Office. The April 2012 figure, the latest available, was 0.7% below the debt figure the local governments were posting in January. Local governments go into debt by selling bonds and using the proceeds to build schools, libraries, roads, jails, clinics, and other facilities. With budgets tight in recent years, the number of new projects being undertaken has dropped. Glaxo moves cancer drug to phase 3. GlaxoSmithKline has moved into phase 3 studies for its melanoma drug cocktail treatment. The trial evaluates the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib, a BRAF inhibitor and an MEK inhibitor respectively. BRAF, or BRAF, is a human gene that makes a particular protein that aids in cell growth. In cancer patients, mutated genes can promote tumor growth. Patients with BRAF mutation-positive metastatic cutaneous melanoma will be evaluated to see if combining the two investigational agents is better than single-drug therapies. BRAF inhibitors have already shown improvement over chemotherapy, but tumors can become resistant to the inhibitors, causing a relapse. The hope is that by adding an MEK inhibitor, that resistance could be delayed. IBM completes Vivissimo buy. IBM has completed its acquisition of Vivissimo. Vivissimo software helps companies organize and analyze big data. Its addition to IBM's software portfolio accelerates IBM's overall big data initiatives. With IDC estimating the market for big data technology and services to grow at an annual rate of nearly 40%, IBM aims to take advantage of Vivissimo by integrating its big data platform. Pittsburgh-based Vivissimo brings with it more than 140 clients and 120 employees. Novant Health to cut 289 jobs, including 103 in Charlotte. Novant Health Incorporated will eliminate 289 jobs, including 103 at Presbyterian Healthcare in Charlotte, citing economic pressures to make healthcare more affordable. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.